said, be brave, my son, I'll be home soon. The boy held on to hope till he got that awful news. And as they folded up Stars and Stripes, 21 guns pointed towards the sky. As the shots rang out, he flinched a little each time. Then a soldier in his best dress walked up to him, and you know the rest.
Operation Encore is a 501c nonprofit that is helping veterans turn into rock stars every single day. You can learn more about what Operation Encore is doing by going over to their website at www.operationencore.org. That is www.operationencore.org. If you can give them a hand, just click that little donate button or follow all of their social medias and learn exactly what they are doing to change the lives of our veterans every single day. Hey, welcome everybody to Spirits and Stories. This is your host, Donald Dunn. Hey, I know our last episode, man, we had a good laugh, and we're going to keep it going this week. We've got Mr. Jack Daly, a native Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and a retired U.S. Naval officer with over 20 years of service to his country in various assignments, including aviation, surface, and amphibious warfare, communications, and intelligence. Jack's first time wearing a United States uniform, red, white, and blue, came at the end of his senior year in high school in 1976 when he represented the United States at the Junior World Rowing Championship, Villach, Austria, in the double school event. During his enlisted days, Jack completed his bachelor's degree and received his commission via officer candidate school in Newport, Rhode Island. Jack works as an emergency management specialist within the Department of Defense today. Let's bring on Jack Daly. Hey, how's it going?
Greetings, Donald. How are you today?
I am doing amazing, man.
Fantastic.
Why don't you give us a brief rundown of who Mr. Jack Daly is?
Yeah, I wonder that every day when I wake up. Yeah, as you mentioned in the intro, born and raised in Philadelphia, went to high school there and college my first year. Tootled on down to Florida for a couple of years of school after that. Kind of got tired with school, was too focused on the rowing still, even after high school, and ended up leaving Florida. Went back to Philly, joined a rowing club that I had been part of before. And I guess about 3 years after being in the private sector, I decided it was time to live a dream I had had ever since I was a kid, and that was to join the Navy.
Okay.
So I didn't have my degree as of yet at that point in 1983, so I enlisted. And went to boot camp out in San Diego, did all my training in San Diego, got assigned to my first ship, the USS England CG-22. It was a guided missile cruiser out of San Diego. And while I was on the England, I had the opportunity to finish my degree. And then, as you mentioned, I got my commission through Officer Candidate School. Started out as a surface warfare officer or a ship driver. But that lasted very briefly because I had torn a ligament in my foot during OCS, and it wasn't conducive to standing on steel decks on the bridge for long hours of time. So the only option I really had at that time was to switch over to intelligence, which was something I had wanted to do initially anyway. So it was fortuitous. It just came by a different means, you know, not the straight direct. It was kind of a screwy path to get there. First tour I did with as an intelligence officer was with the Top Hatters of Fighter Squadron 14 out of Naval Air Station Oceana. And then I was went from there to the Office of Naval Intelligence outside of DC. And it was while I was at the Office of Naval Intelligence, I was handpicked by the Director of Naval Intelligence to be what was called a Foreign Intelligence Liaison Officer. I was approached one day and I was given a choice. I could go to Halifax, Nova Scotia, or I could go to a place called Esquimalt, British Columbia, of which I had never heard about. I had no idea where the heck it was. I knew where British Columbia was, but I didn't know where this town was. And it actually turned out to be the neighboring town to Victoria, British Columbia.
Okay.
So the capital of, or not the capital, but over on Vancouver Island.
Yeah.
And it was during that assignment that I had a little bit of a mishap. I had a run-in with some Ruskies. If you're familiar with that area up in the Pacific Northwest, we have several naval bases up there at Everett and Bremerton, Washington. And then one of the really key installations is at Bangor, Washington. That's where our ballistic missile submarine base is in the Pacific Northwest. And before I had actually departed the Office of Naval Intelligence, I learned that there was an issue up there with Russian and Chinese merchant ships playing around with our ballistic missile submarines during their transits in and out of U.S. territorial waters in what's referred to as the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Fairly large waterway, but still not some place that you want to screw around with a ballistic missile submarine or one of our carriers. So I learned that there was a problem up there. I went up there, I delved into it. I went back to DC, briefed the Director of Naval Intelligence and his staff on what I had learned in 6 months. And the assignment was, let's get some really good pictures of these ships. And I said, okay. And eventually on April 4th of 1997 was sitting in the open doorway of a Canadian helicopter flying around one of these Russian ships called the Capitan Man with a K. And apparently during the flight, as we learned later, they had fired on us as we were flying 360 circles around them to take photographs. And subsequently, after being advised by my chief petty officer, who was a U.S. Navy imagery analyst, he was the best in the Navy at the time. I got to handpick him for the role. He was the one that informed me that we had been exposed to a laser. And then a couple of days later, after reporting it through D.C. and everybody from NORAD to the Pentagon to the Canadian military going on high alert, nothing had ever happened. So, you know, one of those stories, which I'm probably one of hundreds of stories like that in the U.S. military where you were on across the wrong line on a map.
Yep.
Or you were, you know, across the wrong line in airspace or whatever, and you got shot down. But that's essentially the gist of the story. And that's coming out in my second book titled Blind Treason, which is currently under review by the Pentagon. So I can't say a whole heck of a lot about it.
Yeah.
There is an intro to Blind Treason in the back of Laugh Out Loud, plus a 50% off coupon. So I'm just waiting. They've had it for months now, so I'm getting a little anxious. They're a little slow.
With that, you would think it wouldn't take as long with that magic marker that they have. Just
You know, that black redaction marker, you think they go through those books pretty fast. but, you know, that was something that I sat down to write until one day I was driving into work. I was working for Immigration and Customs Enforcement at the time, and I heard a news report on the radio, and it was regarding the number of active duty and veteran suicides. Mm-hmm. And I had been hearing dribs and drabs, but never really heard up to that time any significant numbers or any numbers at all. I just knew that there was some kind of an issue going on. But that report that morning said that in the year 2019, there were 498 active duty military suicides. There were 4,689 or 98 veteran suicides.
Yeah.
So 6,000 higher. And then the craziest thing, the statistic is, there were 198 spouse and dependent suicides in 2019. So I was really taken aback by that. And I thought, geez, what's going on? You know, that nagging question, what is so hard for these folks to deal with mentally and emotionally that they're taking their own lives? I mean, that's a pretty bad way to go in my mind. Yeah. is through suicide. So it stuck in my head all day long. I got home that evening. My wife heard the same report after dinner, and she asked me the very same question. She said, "What's going on?" I said, "I really don't know." I said, "I don't understand it." And I said, "I'd like to be able to do something." And I have a good friend who has some real demons after going to Iraq the second time around. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, if I can just help him, then I've done some kind of good." Because he is a good friend, and he's having a hard time. So I thought, well, what can I do? I asked her, and she asked me, "What did you do in your darkest days after the laser attack?" And I thought to myself, and I said, I laughed. I had to find something to laugh about, because if I didn't, I was just going to end up crying out, making my eyes hurt worse than I already do on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Okay, now what do I do with laugh? I'm not going to be a stand-up comedian. I'm not that funny. I tell dad jokes. And at this point in my life, I'm telling granddad jokes, so it's even worse. And I thought, okay, I'll write a book using the word laugh as a mnemonic, using mm-hmm. each letter of the word as a step in a daily ritual, because I was practicing a daily ritual from a book called The Miracle Morning by Hal Elrod, and his daily rituals is a six-step process called Savers, using mm-hmm. the first letter of the word Savers. And I thought, wait a second, I hate writing. I tell you to this day, and I know it's hard to believe for some folks, I cringe if I have to write a one-line email. It's like, yeah. Can I just pick up the phone and call a guy? So, it led to Laugh Out Loud, and it's really a simple process. You know, you can do it in a matter of 5 minutes, 60 seconds a step, but the backbone of the book, being the word laugh, is to remind people to take the time to laugh every day.
Yeah.
You know, if it's something silly, something dumb, whatever it is, take that time to be able to laugh. And for instance, each of the steps are laugh, you know, find something to laugh about. I use some examples in there that always crack me up, like the guy that used to play the drunk on the Dean Martin roast shows, Foster Brooks.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the funniest skits I've ever seen. And then there's other folks like Tim Conway, an all-time favorite of mine, Robin Williams, God rest his soul.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a comic, a joke of the day, the Far Side cartoons, something that'll get you to crack up, you know, even if it's only for a few minutes. And then the word, the letter A for act, do something, get out and exercise, take a walk, look, you know, don't sit there on your butt in front of the TV or in front of an iPad or your phone, go do something, no matter what it is. So, and then the word you is unplug. Put the device down, you know, walk away from it for a while. Pick up a book, pick up a magazine, read some poetry, whatever it is you can do to get away from that device, get your head out of the device. Because I mentioned that, you know, I have a paragraph in the book that says breaking news. Casket makers are having to build caskets with a bubble at the head of the casket due to people looking down in their phones all the time, walking around, walking in the walls, walking in the phone calls. And they're also building caskets with bubbles for men that overdose on Viagra. And the cause of death determines where the bubble is in the casket.
Yeah.
So then I go to G, grow. Learn something you know nothing about. You know, take up a hobby that you don't necessarily know anything about. Pick up a book that, on a subject that you don't know anything about. You know, train your brain is the idea behind grow. And then the letter H is humor me or us. Make somebody else laugh, because then that's the highest form of, you know, being able to laugh yourself is to be able to make somebody else laugh.
You know, yeah, it becomes contagious.
It does. You're exactly right. It does become contagious. I reference this in the book. I remember when I was in college down in Florida, all the guys on the rowing team that didn't live on campus lived at the boathouse. And the freshman team coach lived in the boathouse in one of the residences. And he was on the phone one night. And we were in the living room of the main house. And myself and another guy were watching, I forget what the heck we were watching. But Steve was on the phone and he had this infectious laugh that you could not ignore, that you just, he had us crying. We were laughing so hard because he was laughing, talking to somebody back at Rutgers, I think. And his laughter was just, it was contagious. I mean, you couldn't stop laughing at him when he was at it. I mean, to the point where we had tears streaming down our cheeks and our sides were splitting. So all he had to do, he didn't even have to open his mouth really. He just had a laugh and we were cracking up. So, you know, the one of the great benefits to laughter is it's been proven that it has health effects on the human body and not only physiological, but also psychological benefits. There was a couple of studies that were commissioned by, I want to say Norman Lear, but that's not the right name. I forget the name off the top of my head. Norman Cousins from the Saturday Evening Post. And it turned out that there is a immunosuppressant uropeptide, I think is the proper pronunciation of it, that is helps release relieve stress through laughter.
Okay.
There's also an immunosuppressant that comes from laughing that is actually aids in the in battling not only the common cold, but cancer, diabetes, arthritis. So there is solid, rock solid proof that laughter is beneficial to the human mind and to the human body as well.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. There's some, as of 2021, there's some 825,000 plus self-help books that have been written on every topic from anxiety to postpartum depression that, you know, new mothers suffer, to zeal wellness. But only 5% of that 825,000 have ever been clinically proven to work. And laughter has been proven repeatedly to work to help in those areas, amongst many others, as I already mentioned.
You know, the one thing I think that kind of proves that, right, is everybody has a natural coping mechanism, right? Mm-hmm. When trauma happens, And I know myself, and I've seen other soldiers do it, so I know I'm not alone. But they all sometimes, when near-death experiences happen after the fact, they sit there and they kind of laugh about it, you know, and they kind of make jokes. And it's a coping mechanism for the body to kind of go, holy crap, that really did happen. And I think just like you proved, you know, if it wasn't a form of therapy or healing, your body wouldn't resort to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up that analogy where the soldier who's had that near-death experience will laugh it off initially.
Yeah.
Because it's almost an immediate reaction for a lot of people. And that's not untrue in a lot of different trauma situations.
Yeah.
Whether you're being held at gunpoint on the streets of New York City or San Antonio, Texas these days, or you've had a near miss in an automobile accident. People, that seems to be a, as you mentioned, a coping mechanism to deal with that immediate response that, oh my God, you know, type of response that you laugh it off. Oh, geez, I'm okay. Wow, that was close, you know?
Yeah.
It's great to be able to laugh. I remember probably the first time I ever heard my oldest daughter, she was about, 6 months old at the oldest. First time I heard her actually laugh. And I had her on my thighs, had my legs propped up on the coffee table. I was watching some show, and somebody on the show said, "Reach for the sky." So I said, "Hey, let me try that." So I did the old index finger and thumb as, you know, the pistol, pointed at my infant on my lap and said, "Reach for the sky." And she broke into such a belly laugh. I can hear it in my ears now. And it was completely unexpected, Donald. And I was cracking up. And I said, okay, I'll try it again. Reach for the sky. And she got even more boisterous laughing. So I had tears streaming down my cheeks and my sides were hurting. And then she just went back to looking around the room, like, you know, taking in the rest of the world.
Yeah.
But that was the sweetest sound I had ever heard in my entire life, was that belly laugh.
Yeah, you know, it is funny, because that's one of the things, even though we just agreed that is a coping mechanism, right? But as these veterans get into depression, or not just veterans, anybody that's dealing with depression, that it gets harder and harder to find that mechanism, you know, and you have to get to the point where you now are consciously looking for reasons to laugh, because, you know, you're just getting beat down with these demons, and it's hard to get yourself back out there. So it's kind of good, like what you said, you know, reminding people, hey, you know, if you're not laughing today, you need to search out a reason to laugh today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people forget about that. They forget about how their initial response was laughter and how good it made them feel after their event happened, you know. Yeah. And I'm sure that's not for everybody, but, you know, I think it plays a big role in that.
Well, I think it plays a huge role, you know. My buddy who's dealing with the demons from his time in Iraq, I always try to get him to laugh about something, and he has a high IQ and a very high and fine-tuned sense of humor, where sarcasm is his go-to.
Yeah.
Not so much making something humorous, but if he can throw sarcasm in on top of it and wrap it in sarcasm, that works for him. So yeah. I try to keep him going in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've been preparing a presentation for the DoD organization that I currently work for, which is the Defense Continuity and Mission Assurance group within the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And as I've been doing my research on the statistics, I saw a new one the other day that really caught my attention. And that was last year, there were over 500,000, so 500,000, half a million phone calls to the DoD Crisis Prevention Hotline.
Wow. I did not know that.
That's mind-boggling to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, realistically, I mean, these last few years hasn't helped, you know.
No.
You know, our veterans that were in the service were put in situations where, you know, not all of them, but some of them were stationed in Korea. Some of them mm-hmm. were deployed. Some of them, you know, they were away from their families, and then COVID hit, and now they're stuck still away from their families because the military, at least the Army, did put a no PCSing freeze yeah. where nobody could change duty stations. And so you had the COVID situation that happened, and if you were already depressed before that, well, you were definitely going to be extremely depressed by the time it was over with. And I think the other part of that made it harder on the veterans community is most of us, when we left the military, the only tool they really gave us for emotions was anger. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how you dealt with everything. And I think that didn't play very well during the COVID time frame either, because people were already so looking for reasons to fight. You know, you had the pro masks, the anti masks, the pro vax, the unpro vax, you know. And you know, I know for me, when I'm not on my medication, somebody just stopping in front of me at Walmart is enough to piss me off. And so I can imagine those time frames was even harder for the veteran community. So I would expect to see at least people are calling, you know, that's a good start right there.
Yeah.
You know, and the VA's done some good things. You know, I know everybody likes to talk bad about them. They're not perfect, but they are extremely overwhelmed. And that new that new policy that they passed, where if you're a veteran, and even if you're not enrolled in the VA, you can go to any hospital now, you know, and get help, and the VA will cover it. You know, it does not matter where it is, who it is, you know, if you served, you can go. And I think that's awesome as well.
I agree. That's a huge plus for our vets, that they didn't have to wait for months on end, in some cases, depending upon location, years at a time to get in to be seen at a VA hospital. I know working in the DC area, it was ridiculous to try and get an appointment in there. Months on end before you could get an appointment. So that definitely was a big plus. Somebody had their head screwed on straight that came up with that option.
Yeah. It was probably a contractor.
Yeah, probably a government contractor. Yeah, probably a Beltway bandit specifically,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So you write this book, right? And I know for me, so I just released my first book, and it is not a self-help book, but it's just kind of a my story. And mm-hmm. I originally wrote it for my children and my wife to kind of explain the things that I was going through during some of my darkest times. And I wrote it more as just like a letter to them. It wasn't a mm-hmm. book, you know. And after my daughter read it, she recommended that I publish it. So I went ahead and published it. But I think that was probably the hardest thing to do, mm-hmm. was write a book like that. And I kind of put it in the same category as a self-help book, because you're analyzing everything. You know, you have to look at this from a third person standpoint and ask yourself, you know, how am I reaching the people? How am I perceiving myself to be? And to make sure it's all factual. Did you struggle with coming up with the stuff for this book as well?
It wasn't so much with this one, but for Blind Treason, where I talk about the laser attack and the aftermath, all the I'll be blunt, if you don't mind, all the BS that followed as a result of the cover-up of the attack, because it happened in U.S. waters with Canadian, you know, a helicopter flying in U.S. airspace, and a Russian spy ship, you know, lights us up with a laser. Writing some of the aftermath has been the hardest part for me. I've really struggled with that part. And it's, I still have a lot more writing to do with it. And I know that those days are not, I'm not going to be in the best mood.
No, for me too. You know, it took me a year and a half to get through the part that I was giving to my kids, you know, because I would get to parts and I would put it down and not pick it up for months and just,
I get it, you know,
and it's tough. And I finally, you know, through podcasting, I found a support group. They're not a nonprofit, but they're a for-profit company, but, but man, it helped me out tremendously. And they're the reasons why I really was able to get through the book, was with their help. And, I think it's important for people to understand first, you know, you go to the VA, you get some medication or whatever, and you start feeling better. Depression and PTSD is not like the common cold. You know, once the symptoms are gone, you're healed. There's real work that you have to do, to get through that. And the medication is there to assist you, to help you do that part. And if you don't do that part, you're not going to, you know, once you come off of it or you stop taking it, you're going to go right back to where you was at. And, I know, cause I've tried to get off my medications a couple times, and, it's tough, but doing some writing like what you did and like what I did, I think is also very, helpful, because while you're writing it, you are analyzing everything you're putting. You're not necessarily thinking about the event, but you're analyzing the events that happened. And I'm not saying you have to publish it. You don't have, you know, you can burn it as soon as you're done writing it if you wanted to, but just the act of putting it on paper and taking that time to think about it is, does wonders, you know?
And if you, I agree.
If you can implement a system like yourself along with that, you're on the track to healing. You know, if you at night you write a page or two pages, and then the next day you practice like what you were saying, the LAUGH acronym, you know, throughout the day, you're on your right, you're on the right track of getting back out of that hole. You know?
Yeah, it's in my particular situation, it's been very therapeutic.
It's
as I'm sure it has been for you or was for you. It's really difficult when you're typing away at the keyboard and you're thinking about those memories and you're reliving everything. You're reliving all those moments, and those demons are staring you right in the face. They're not in the back of your mind at that point. When you're writing about them, they're staring you right eyeball to eyeball. And for me, it's been kind of a double-edged sword in the fact that the incident took place almost 27 years ago. So it'll be 27 years ago this April 4th. I haven't had a pain-free minute in almost 27 years. And I've been to see some of the best doctors and scientists in the world that know anything about laser bio effects. And they have told me, we don't know what to do for you. We've never heard a story like this. We've never had a patient come and say, oh, I looked at a laser pointer and now my eyes hurt. But that's not necessarily true. There are some of those stories. But in the United States military, until I walked through the door in San Antonio with the rest of the air crew, nobody had told those guys, wow, this really hurts. Because they had been pointing lasers at Reese's monkeys, but Reese's monkeys can't say, ow, you son of a bitch, that hurts. Stop.
Yeah, you're right.
So the double-edged sword is the pain and then not having not having any relief from it and nobody able to do anything about it. And some days it's debilitating.
Yeah.
So I tell my family I'm the best weather guesser ever born, because there can be a storm front 3 days out and I'll feel it in my eyeballs before they ever announce it on the weather forecast.
Yeah.
So writing about it gives me some psychological relief from the pain.
Absolutely.
But it also throws in a dose of the psychological. It triggers the PTSD feelings every once in a while.
Yep.
In addition to some of the things that I saw when I was on active duty.
Yeah, no, I can completely relate, because as I was going through those chapters, I did notice the nightmares and the dreams started coming back that yeah. I guess I kind of compartmentalized and was starting to sleep. Well, what I call sleep, 4 or 5 hours. Mm-hmm. And, after going through this book, you know, I did those all did start coming back. Yeah. And so it does, it's exactly what it does do. But on that same token, you have to rewire your brain. And in order to do that, you have to mess with those wires that have been routed that way.
Right.
And you can do it in pieces, sections, time, what at your pace, whatever, you know. There's no race to healing. And but the thing is that when you're done, you have to make sure that you have completely created a new path to help you get through those things. And I'm not saying that you'll forget and it's completely gone. That's not what I'm saying at all. But what I am saying is the work that you do by repeating it and saying it and seeing it numbs the pain a little bit, mm-hmm. allow you to deal with it now versus your body having to deal with it because you're not.
Right. Yep. Yeah, I agree. The hardest part, I guess, for me with writing the second book, Blind Treason, is reliving all of the cover-up aspect.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To a point where I had done another podcast last week, and the gentleman that put it together, he did an intro and he put a couple of links in the bottom of the introduction before he sent it out. And he sent me the key link to get to the whole thing. And I said, wow, I've never seen this Wikipedia page before. And I clicked on it and it was a hit piece. It was written to totally discredit us. It was written to also totally discredit the doctor that diagnosed us, to the point where the head of the Army Medical Research Detachment organization that we were sent to, we were medevaced to, he threw all of his coworkers under the bus. He published a medical article in one of the journals, medical journals, and he threw his whole team that diagnosed us, he just threw them all under the bus. The doctor, the scientists, the whole crew.
Wow.
For what reason? Boggles my mind. I think it was some payback, because we put him in a bad position one day when I took the Russian shipping company to personal injury court. And that was hard to deal with Monday night. I woke up Sunday night, I saw it. I woke up Monday morning like I was back in the thick of things.
Yeah.
That I was dodging those bullets. And you know, trying to get my credibility back that had been so tarnished at the time, because I think the hardest part for me to deal with was I was called a traitor by my own organization.
Wow.
I was accused of withholding intelligence from the United States, that I was putting our ballistic missile submarine crews and our carrier battlegroup crews at risk, withholding intelligence about what these Chinese and Russian ships were doing up there. And that was the furthest thing from the truth.
Yeah.
That was somebody else trying to cover their six,
yep,
because they hadn't done their job. And I had no qualms about saying that it was an intelligence failure, even while I was still wearing a uniform. And I was pointing fingers and naming people that were responsible for the intelligence failure. Well, you know what they say about payback.
Yep.
Yeah. So it came fast and furious for a long time. And had it not been for the power of the pen, had it not been for a reporter by the name of Bill Gertz, who wrote national security pieces for the Washington Times, I really would have been hung out to dry. I mean, he pretty much saved my bacon right off the bat when he broke the story. And then there were several other stories written about the attack. It showed up in Reader's Digest. It showed up in Soldier of Fortune. It was showing up in all kinds of newspapers and magazines and radio shows. And had it not been for that press coverage, I would have been railroaded right out of the Navy. They did try to pass me over twice for promotion, which meant I was out the door because it was two strikes you're out in the Navy. But a guy by the name of Jesse Helms, a senator from North Carolina, got involved. And the next thing I knew, I was getting a third look for promotion from 03 to 04. So it was fortunate for me that I had those kind of people in my corner.
Yeah.
Not that I sought them out, but they showed up. One of the ones you would probably recognize the name, David Hackworth,
mm-hmm,
showed up to help me out. And he was a great guy. We became good friends. I'm sorry, he's deceased now, but it was people like David Hackworth and Jesse Helms and Ross Perot that came, not necessarily to my rescue, but were in my corner.
You know, I think something else people need to understand, this is all happening in the early 80s, right?
This was the late 90s, 97.
Oh, 97. Okay. So this was after the Cold War era.
Right.
Right. But even still afterwards, I don't think any of that has gone away. There's always been, you know, tension between US and Russia. And so I bet you there is a bunch of stories out there of cover-ups, because I know for a fact that they come in our waters, and I'm sure we go into their waters all the time. Mm-hmm. And for there not to be contact in some way, some form, you'd have to be pretty low on the intelligence scale to believe that, you know? Right. So I do believe there's probably been a lot of cover-ups that has came about from this. And it is hard because, as a soldier, you know, all you have is your identity. You know, you have your purpose, your motivation, and your identity. While you're serving, you're somebody.
Right.
You're part of a team that is bigger than yourself. And when you leave that military, you try to take that with you, and you learn real quick that identity doesn't go with you anymore, because you're now mixed in the civilian world with a bunch of people that can't understand your stories or relate to them in any way. And so to have what you had left of your identity being trying to be erased as well, I can absolutely understand how furious you would be, yeah, you know?
Yeah. Especially in a field like intelligence, your word is your credibility, and your credibility is your word.
Yeah.
And have that questioned was extremely difficult for me to deal with, because I knew what the truth was.
Yeah.
I mean, for instance, this this has been a disturbing part of the saga. And I ran into two different, one was a friend, a family friend in Philadelphia. The other was a contractor in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And they both told me a similar story. They were both at a relative's home, and one of the guests in each of these scenarios was a senior U.S. Navy admiral, not the same guy, but just happened to be an admiral on the East Coast, was a Philadelphia party, admiral on the West Coast, San Diego party. And they both told me the same story. They mentioned my name and they got the Heisman, said, I don't even want to hear that SOB's name.
Yeah.
So that left me with the only logical thought I could come up with is, what the hell were they told about me?
Yeah.
Were they told I was making this story up? Because that was one of the storylines, that I had made this whole thing up, which was just ludicrous. Because how was I convincing the Canadian pilot who had a lucrative civilian career lined up a couple of months later, he was retiring. How did I convince a guy I never met before in my life until that day to be part of a lie like this?
Yeah.
And then the logical next question is, why would I do that? I was on a fast track for promotion to 04. I got handpicked by the director of Naval Intelligence, who was a guy who was hated or loved. That was just the kind of guy he was. And why would I do that? Why would I torpedo my career, pun intended?
Yeah.
Being a Navy guy, right?
Well, let me ask you this. So you said that you seeked out legal actions against the Mariner company that they were aboard. How did that go? Did it get shut down pretty quick too? I kind of imagine it did.
Yeah, it so it was a personal injury lawsuit against it's called the Far Eastern Shipping Company, FESCO, mm-hmm. which was the owner of the Capitan Man. Now, the Capitan Man was built for military service. It was a roll-on, roll-off vessels where the vehicles, tanks, whatever, would roll in from the stern and roll off at the bow when they hit a beach or a causeway or whatever. And we filed through an organization that was representing me legally called Judicial Watch, which you may have heard of. They were going after the Clintons. This all happened during Bill Clinton's administration, by the way.
Okay.
If that puts some context for your listeners about the story. And they were going after him. They learned of me. They reached out to me and said, you know, if you want us to represent you, yada, yada, yada. And that was just to hold on to my Navy career. And then as I was successful in that regard with their assistance, we went after the shipping company that owned the Capitan Man in a personal injury lawsuit. Had nothing to do with the Navy. The Navy was not a party to the lawsuit. Mm-hmm. But the Office of Naval Intelligence testified on behalf of the Russian shipping company.
Wow.
One of the craziest things was Judicial Watch, their key weapon in their quiver was FOIA requests. They write an extensive FOIA request that leaves no stone unturned, no sticky note, no piece of paper, no book, nothing. Everything's game in their FOIA requests. So we had submitted a FOIA request to the Office of Naval Intelligence for their report that they had done on the attack. Mm-hmm. I had read the report. I knew it was BS, but we requested it. We got a response back from the Office of Naval Intelligence, said, no, this is classified. We cannot turn this over. About 3 months later, I was going through a set of documents that the other side, that the Russian shipping company, FESCO's lawyer, had provided to Judicial Watch as part of the discovery process. The second document I pulled out of the box was the Office of Naval Intelligence report on the laser attack. They had declassified it and given it to the Russians.
But they wouldn't give it to you.
But they weren't willing to give it to me.
Wow.
So this hit piece I mentioned to you, I mean, they even doctored the evidence. So the telltale picture I had taken that my chief imagery analyst said, hey, I think you caught a laser in this photograph. That picture was provided to the Office of Naval Intelligence the day, 2 days after the attack. When it was released by ONI to the press, the picture looked entirely different. Now, I took this picture at about 12:20 in the afternoon on a perfectly clear day, unlimited visibility, especially up in the air. And what they handed to the press looked like the picture was taken at midnight. So one of the technical experts that Judicial Watch hired when we sued the shipping company was an instructor at the FBI Academy, whose specific area of expertise is imagery analysis. Mm-hmm. So when he testified in the trial, he said that that specific image had been manipulated over 85 times. He said, I just stopped counting at 85. It was probably double that.
Wow.
So they completely skewed the evidence once again to discredit us, to make it look like something it wasn't. And it's, you know, it's mind-boggling to the extent that the cover-up was undertaken.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't understand. I get, because the Canadian military was involved as well as there. So I do understand that there's some foreign ties there that they don't necessarily want to be known about, but I still don't see what the damage would have been just to acknowledge what it is, you know. At the end of the day, if anything, it showed the strength of our U.S. military out there dealing with this situation versus just watching a weather balloon go over three quarters of the United States, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, so at least we were doing something, and you would think that that's kind of what you'd want to show in the media. Is that we're actively engaged. I can't even answer why all this was done. How much of your book do you actually think will be not marked out when you get it back?
Well, I conducted a litmus test using the introduction that's in the back of Laugh Out Loud.
Uh-huh.
So I took some pretty wide liberties in writing that introduction to see what would come back after, because that had to be reviewed as well. It was like a two pager, if that, on 8.5 by 11 paper. And I waited several months for it, and it came back and not a single word was redacted. So in my response to your question, I'm hopeful that most of it will not be redacted. And I do have to do a significant rewrite on it because I threw a lot of stuff in that was about me growing up. But in talking to a television producer in the last couple of months, she goes, nah, you got to get the whole story in one book, because then we can talk about, you know, a potential TV gig or movie or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm keeping my fingers crossed. It's been, I think it's going on 6 months now. I did reach out and they said, well, we had to send it out far and wide, so we're still waiting for feedback. I'm sure they had to send it to Canada and they had to send it to the Navy and Office of Naval Intelligence for their review. I filed a FOIA request with the Office of Naval Intelligence for all records relating to either myself and or the Capitan Man and or the laser attack April 4th of 1997. And the response I got back was, we don't hold personnel records. You'll have to go to the Bureau of Records. What about the records regarding the laser attack or the Capitan Man? They completely sidestepped it.
Yeah. And I thought those were classified. They wouldn't be in the the Bureau of Records.
Right. You know? Yeah. Well, the fact that it happened, it's now 25 years hence the attack. Most things are normally declassified after 25 years, all depending upon how the information was gathered. They might say, well, you were a human intelligence source, so that has to stay classified for 50 years. I don't know. I hope they don't pull that one on me.
Yeah.
The thing I have going as a counter is I have all of the court documents and all the deposition documents that pretty much tell 99% of the story.
Yeah.
That I could say, look, this is public record. You know, you can't redact this stuff. It's public record.
Yeah.
So I have a feeling it's going to be a battle. If the book is published this year, this calendar year, I'll be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, man, I wish you the best of luck.
Well, thank you.
I do got one more tough question since you were talking about a movie. If this became a movie, who is it that's going to play you?
You know, the producer asked me that too. I would love to say Tom Hanks, but I don't think they can make him look that young. You know,
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, he can do amazing things with makeup, right?
Yeah, AI is pretty good.
Yeah, AI is pretty good. I don't know, man. Maybe Chris Helmsworth.
Yeah, there you go. Okay.
Possibly. Yeah.
All right. Well, Jack, I'm going to bring you forward, man, let you tell everybody where they can get your book and if there's any place that they can get an autographed version of your book as well. So go ahead and give yourself a plug and tell the world how to find you.
Yeah, the easiest, most logical place these days to find Laugh Out Loud, your personal prescription for the best medicine on earth, is on Amazon. Right now, it's currently in paperback as well as electronic or Kindle version. And both can be found on the website. My only ask is if you do happen to purchase a copy or download a copy, and you can, if you have a Kindle Unlimited plan, you can read it for free, is to leave a review and let me know what you think of it. So that's about the best place. If you're not a typical Amazon book purchaser, you can do a Google search and it should show up on Barnes and Noble and a couple of the other book outlets.
All right. Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to have, you know, all the links down below when we release this episode as well. So everybody will be able to just click on it and go straight to checkout. You know, that's what they need to do.
Sounds great.
All right, Jack. Well, I appreciate you coming on. I'm going to put you in the green room and then throw my exit video out, and I'll be right with you.
Okay, Donald. Thank you, sir. All right.
Take care.
My pleasure.
All right, everybody. Man, can you imagine that? Just, you know, you'd going through something and spending all these years serving a branch, and then when you walk away from, even as your employer, you just get erased like it didn't even happen. Man, that is a tough pill to swallow, you know, and the fact that Jack is writing about it and making people aware is amazing as well. And at the same time, even taking the time to help veterans, you know, with his book, Laugh Out Loud. So I can vouch, laughter is very therapeutic. It will help you. If you forgot that, make an effort to go out there and find something funny. It'll be contagious, and who knows, that person that you made laugh, you don't know what they're going through, man. That might have been what they needed to stay alive one more day. So I hope all of y'all enjoyed this show. I know I did. I look forward to seeing all of y'all next week. Y'all take care. Don't forget, don't let the day kick your ass. Kick the day's ass.